Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi.
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 Yep, Sci-Fi, 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 a podcast about science fiction audiobooks, hosted by three guys who are in a container under a river somewhere.
Containers under the sea.
We don't know where we are, actually.
Well, I mean, does anybody really know where they are?
We're actually a giant turtle under a sea.
It's turtles all the way down.
Uh-huh.
It's podcasters all the way down.
Yes. So,
is that why we never win?
So, yes, we are reading a Hugo finalist book today. Kevin, I think this was your nominal choice.
Yes.
So would you like to tell us which one we are discussing?
New York 2140 by Kim Stanley Robinson.
Are you sure it's not 2140?
Or 2140?
Yes, I can tell you in binary if you want.
All it's comedy gold.
It's, you know, open to interpretation.
Written in 2017.
Uh-huh. Who was it narrated by?
A bunch of people.
Okay, great. Would you give us a reading of the back of the book, please? TM.
The waters rose, submerging New York City, but the residents adapted, and it remained the bustling, vibrant metropolis it had always been, though changed forever. Every street became a canal, every skyscraper an island. Through the eyes of the varied inhabitants of one building, Kim Stanley Robinson shows us how one of our great cities will change with the rising tides, and how we too will change.
Okay.
That was a gloriously short back of the book.
And it didn't really spoil a whole lot.
Yeah. Barry, what did you think about all of this?
I really like the book.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this is a great how-to manual for how to get rich in the future, you know, based on sea level change.
It's your favorite kind of book.
That's right. How to get rich. I mean, there's no time crime, so there's some minus points there. But
right.
And there are a few cringy moments that we'll get to in the spoiler section. But overall, I really enjoyed the book.
Okay. Yeah. This book actually had a lot of really interesting concepts, and a lot of them sort of were really intriguing and mixed in really well with sort of the things that I'd already been talking about. So I'm kind of reviewing my own ideas right now. But the only problem is that not all the characters kind of grabbed me. It's one of these, it's sort of a disaster novel type of thing, or a slice of life. I mean, it's Kim Stanley Robinson. This is sort of his MO. Mm-hmm. He's got a bunch of characters and their lives sort of intersect or don't intersect. And some of the characters I absolutely fell in love with, and some of them I was just like, okay, move on. Can we just, you know, the problem with audiobooks is you can't just sort of skip ahead until, you know, your favorite character comes back on again.
I don't understand. People actually do that when they read books.
Yeah. I also do that with TV shows. Right. I get attached to certain characters in some shows, like The Wire and Tremé and, you know, that type of show.
Right.
Then I get like super upset when something bad happens to them.
He watches The Twilight Zone and just watches Rod Serling's introduction
over and over again.
Oh, yeah, more. Tell me more.
Kevin, what did you think?
I liked it. It was a pretty good post-apocalyptic book. And
no actual zombies.
Well, you know, like I said, zombies aren't my requirement. They're just an okay side effect sometimes.
I mean, there was this sort of really capitalist guy that was kind of like a zombie.
Yeah, he was kind of a jerk. Yeah, I did like the sort of the descriptions of how to deal with living in sort of semi-destroyed underwater buildings and stuff like that. And, you know, kind of they had their co-ops and things. You know, we can go in the spoiler section more, but, you know, there was sort of like new tech that comes after like flooding disaster happens. It's like, oh, we couldn't have done that before, could we? Ho-ho. You know, it's like, so there's a lot
necessity is the mother of invention.
Yeah, it's kind of like a lot of preaching to the choir, you know, for me, where it's sort of like, oh gosh, we couldn't possibly have done this until it was too late.
Right.
With various, you know, climate disaster stuff.
So you and I don't really disagree on it that much. What we should do is develop this technology now because we know it's going to happen.
Right.
And, you know, therefore be rich before everybody else.
Agreed.
Selling, you know, what is it, graphene compounds and spray diamond dust or something, and I don't know.
Right. And so
I actually thought this book was more speculative fiction than post-apocalyptic.
Yeah.
It's kind of got a foot in both, but
it's, well, because it's probably going to happen this way, you know, so whatever. There's a whole financial section that it's like, obviously, like he's read The Big Short or, you know, stuff based on the 2008.
He's read a lot of things, and he kind of wants you to know about that.
Right. So there's a whole section on subprime mortgage loans and, you know, nothing that bad. They kind of make a joke about it, you know, but almost as bad. And so, yeah, it's,
there's a lot of financial, economic, and political theory.
Right. I will say the...
And social theory.
And social theory.
Yeah, so I kind of enjoyed those parts. I enjoyed the future stuff, the disaster stuff. I did not enjoy the history of New York, which I can't really express how much I don't care. So that's not the book's fault. That's my fault. But like, yeah. You know...
Weirdest thing. Kim Stanley Robinson lives in Davis, the anti-New York.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, if it was set near where we live, you know, if it was in Santa Cruz or even maybe San Francisco, I would have found that more interesting. But that's just, you know, that's my problem. So, yeah, I will advance a couple of my, I guess you could technically say it's a spoiler, but it's not codes. It's not code. It's code. Code is the word. Plural of code is code. There's no S at the end.
Well, that was exciting.
I feel... undifferent at this time.
Yes. Programs, code.
Well, that's great.
It's executable, I mean, sir, I'm not yes.
concerned that
it's not geese.
The
it's
sheer
geese.
Amount of wonderful in this segment might overwhelm our listeners. Yes. So I'm going to try to do our witty seg. This is going to be a buckle in, folks. this just comes right off the top of the dome. You know, we don't pre-plan these or nothing. Let's see. So we're going to bleach ourselves off of the non-spoiler intertidal water and head for the open waters of the review section. We shall return, for we are sci-fi.
Sci-fi.
Sci-fi. Welcome back to our review section.
Yeah, thanks, Barry. Yes, this is our review section for New York 2140 by Kim Stanley Robinson.
2140, you're right. Correct.
Of course. Okay, yes. So what did people think, first of all, about all the financial stuff in this here book?
I'm sure that's how it's going to happen, so it seemed pretty realistic to me.
I mean, yeah, I had been thinking a lot about sort of economics in the wider sense, and... the problem was that there is so much of it that I kept on pulling away from, like, the story for me, especially because there are long sort of intro segments on each chapter,
right.
Especially since I was listening to it at 3x speed because I kind of had gotten out of the narrative and I had to sort of talk myself back into listening. So suddenly, you know, suddenly like there's this long snatch of dialogue and I'm just like, what's going on? Who's talking? And then it's just like, Dorothy Parker. Oh, you know, this was all this long quote.
Right. I mean, the funny thing is some of the stuff actually made sense to me because I just took a class on machine learning, like financial stuff. And so I'm like, oh, I'm actually familiar with some of the stuff they reference and that kind of stuff. And, you know, I'm not like an expert, but at least I knew the terminology somewhat. So I wasn't totally lost in that first part. Like,
yeah. My other problem with it was there is one character. Yes. Franklin Garr, who, seems to embody finance in all of its forms. I mean, you know, there's this...
Clooney's a real great guy.
Yeah. He reminded me a lot of the guy Mitch from Space Merchants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's sort of that 50s, you know, businessman, you know, it's like, oh, you know, women are here to, you know, please me and, you know, right. That sort of thing.
I mean, he never seemed to be... terribly sexist. He would just...
Oh, he's not sexist. He's just like a...
horn dog.
Well, I might even be something beyond a horn dog, but yeah.
Right.
Well, yes, he was very...
like, I've got to get her to like me again. Yeah, I have
just
to. Like,
or stop. Just yeah. Stop.
Walk away, man. Just
because, you know... you know, okay, to be fair, it's not like this concept had never occurred to me when I was a lot younger. It's just like, okay, So in order for this girl to like me, all I have to do is change every single thing about myself.
Good idea.
Okay, that's what I'm doing.
Yeah, sounds like a great plan.
Yeah, doesn't actually work. You can't actually do that. You can fool yourself into thinking you've done that for about a week.
I'll trick her into liking me.
That seemed to be almost his other plan. He's just like, oh, well, she doesn't like me because I'm all about finance. Yes, dude. Yes, you are. You were making finance jokes while the two of you were having sex. And that was excruciating.
Oh, yeah.
So was that part.
That part was excruciating. I mean, as a narrator, you kind of have to do that, I guess. But you're just
sounded really good at 3x speed.
The chipmunks.
I guess my problem with that character is that his horn-doggedness or, you know, desire to really, you know, try and get into her pants again didn't actually add anything to the story.
Right.
You know, it was just sort of tacked on. And for a book that was, you know, written rather recent, you know, this last year, right, it just seems a little incongruous.
There's one thing that
I don't want to say I'm outraged, but I'm slightly like irritated.
I think there are people that actually are like that. So, you know, it's not totally unrealistic, but it's,
you know. Yeah. I mean, some people will, you know, deeply object to it. A giant jerk.
He was just kind of annoying. And he was, to be fair, he was supposed to be annoying at the beginning.
Yeah.
And also, I kind of liked the fact that, you know, he kind of tried to change himself to please this woman. And it turned out that actually, it seemed to me like we never figured out exactly what her deal was.
They kind of implied through his eyes that, you know, she was just having a good time. And she's like, it wasn't anything for me. We were just having a good time.
Right.
Please go away.
We went out a couple of times and that was it. Right.
Right.
And he's, a lot more out of it than it really needs.
Yeah. And there's also the scene at the end where, you know, he's kind of like, you know, getting in bed with Charlotte, right? And he's like super obsessed with the fact that she's like 15 years older than he is.
And it's just like, yeah, okay, stop worrying about it.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like 25 years or, you know, something more drastic.
Yeah.
But he spent, you know, the book spends like probably like a chapter, like half a chapter talking about it. It's like, can you just get over it already?
And actually thinking about it, he said, you know, that he was 30 towards the end, right?
Yeah.
Mid-30s, I think.
Mid-30s. And a lot of his attitudes are more 20-year-old, I would think, at least towards sex. He takes up a fair amount of the narrative, and I just never quite warmed up to him. He didn't seem like a bad guy, but...
Well, yeah, he's not like he's the villain or anything. He's just... And he does do a fair number of things begrudgingly, like, you know, helping rescue, you know, Stefan and what's the other kid's name?
Roberto,
you know, when they get trapped in a diving bell. Well, at least he gets Vlade and takes them over there and pretends to assist. And
he's not a bad guy.
He's kind of self-interested, and that's he just wants to do what he wants to do.
He's got two things on his mind: making money and
having sex.
Yeah.
that bit at the end where he's just like, okay, let's go in the cabin and have sex. Just like, oh, wow, smooth guy.
It's like, wow, everything is a transaction for you.
Yeah. On the other hand, my favorite character was Amelia Black, rather excitable, but I maintain that she was actually fairly smart. She was very emotional, but she, you know, she lived in an airship and she was, you know, migrating these polar bears to the South Pole. I thought they lived there already.
I thought she was like a really fun element to the story.
Right.
Especially since
we'll get back to her with my favorite scenes later on, I think.
Yeah, I
was going to bring up bears because, you know, as we all know, we all love bears.
Yeah. Mostly you, but yes.
It bears repeating.
Grr, grr, grr.
Yes, I actually, you know, this is another one of those, oh, she lives in a cloud ship. She, you know, she lives in her dirigible or whatever. It's like, I want to do that. Can I have one?
It's like Mishima and her, her?
Crow.
Crow, yeah.
Yeah, I know. This is, I kind of thought of that too. And I was like, yeah, I want one. That part's good.
And this actually has...
you want a blimp or a dirigible?
Some certain dirigible resonances with the whole micro-democracy series, Malka Older.
Yeah. So then there were, I mean, the other main characters, you know, like Vlade, he was sort of like the building superintendent.
Sure.
And, you know, I will say there were a lot of convenient, you know, people that everyone knew in the narrative, or it's like, oh, good thing my ex-wife is this person who can do dredging and stuff like that, you know.
And everybody had an ex that was somehow absolutely necessary for the story.
Right. Much. It's like, oh, good thing that my ex is, you know, runs the Federal Reserve or whatever and all this stuff. So yeah, there was a lot of convenience, but you know, you kind of ignored that. And then of course there are the fools, Mutt and Jeff, the quants or whatever, the programmers that kind of started the...
Right. You know, they were the ones that were in the container that was sunk under a river most of the time.
Right. And they were sort of like the nominal plot line that kind of was running through a lot of the stuff.
You know, it's funny because like on the second listen, I didn't realize just how early in the book that those guys got kidnapped.
Yeah.
First 10 minutes of the book, something like that.
Not 10 minutes, but it's like chapter 10, I think, out of...
I mean, did we actually see them... No, it was like the
first chapter they got kidnapped.
Yeah, did we see them before they were suddenly popping up in the container? I don't remember.
Yeah, they were having discussions about living on the farm level and the hotelos and,
right.
you know, yeah. the Met and how they got there. But yeah, it was like within the first hour, I think, out of, what, 23 hours right. of this book.
And so, yeah, everybody lives in this one building or sort of winds up living there after more flooding happens. And I really liked sort of the idea of the building where they're literally offered billions of dollars for it. And they're saying, no, because
we want to live here.
Yeah, we just want to live here. Money won't actually help us that much. What are we going to do with that?
Right. Well, I mean, there are the other, you know, new skyscrapers, right, that are even larger and more... you know, quote, exclusive, unquote.
Right.
But, you know, you have to be, you know, much more than a millionaire to live there.
Right, exactly. And the other thing that I thought was sort of interesting was very early on in the book, they find billions of dollars worth of gold, and that's just sort of a minor subplot.
Right.
Well, it's sort of like a running gag throughout, you know, New York history of, you know, where's the Hussar gold? I mean, even I kind of vaguely remember hearing something about that, you know, a long time ago. You know, might be apocryphal, but
yeah, I was perfectly prepared for that to turn out to be just like this crazy fool's errand because it was like, you
know, hunt.
An old man and two crazy boys that don't seem to have a lot of sense. And right. I was sort of surprised when it's just like, oh, nope, gold's
we
there.
We found it. Yeah.
And money doesn't really change anything. They don't right. seem to have a lot of sense even after they, you know, somehow managed to find it all.
And the boys are like, maybe it should go in a museum. And the police person's like, I just melt it down. Otherwise, you know, right. you'll never get any of it. And like, it'll take 30 years to go through the course.
But I want to wear one around my neck.
It's just like, okay, take one.
Yeah. Put it in your pocket.
Exactly.
But I thought it was kind of funny too that, you know, Mutt and Jeff very early on, you know, are sort of identified as, you know, in their roles of the fools right. or
they're,
whatever.
They're Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, Jeff's last name is Rosen. And he says, hey, have you ever read Rosencrantz and Guildenstern to the other one? And you're like, and then some other thing, which I'm sure is an equivalent thing that I didn't get. And like,
I mean, okay, did he literally say, have you ever read Rosencrantz
yes,
and Guildenstern?
That.
Because that's not a thing.
He are dead, but yeah.
Okay.
But yes, he did say that. And,
you know, fun fact, that was based on another play.
Oh, really?
Really? Yeah. What one?
I believe it was Macbeth.
I thought it was Sublet, something like that.
Yeah, that was it. Sublet.
Yeah, there's Sublet in the building.
Story about a prince that is trying desperately to rent out his room in a castle.
His dad left it to him in his will or something.
And then there's this ghost that keeps on popping up, scaring the guys out.
Yeah, you
it's just spam.
You just
Sublet, oh, revenge for Liese.
Get back in your hotel.
Sorry, joke.
Oh, man. So, yes, that was amusing.
Well, they also kind of conveniently set up the idea that there could be some sort of more equitable financial utopia in the future, right? They spend like the first, you know, hour of the book, or within the first hour of the book, they talk about how they were going to change the rules of finance, you know, by changing
right.
by changing some, you know, securities and exchange codes.
Yes, the codes.
Yeah, we can find Kevin's berserk button here, ladies and gentlemen.
Watch this. Poke, 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 poke.
Yeah, and that part, you know, it's one of those things that you want to believe could actually happen. You know, it was a little bit convenient that it did actually happen in the book. I mean, it was sort of the point, you know, I think, but
so deliberately engineering a bubble burst
that, and also instead of just having a bailout where the government's like, okay, well, the markets are going to go down. We better give you money and nothing changes. Oh, well, that they're like, okay, no, we'll actually federalize the banks. And you know, you know, China's like, hey, it's a good idea. It's worked for us for a few thousand years.
Yeah.
And like, so yeah, that's the kind of thing that you know, even if that doesn't happen, you know, something along those lines could possibly happen for some of the market.
You know, China is that financial utopia that we all dream of, right?
I know. Everything's great. But, you know, it's just sort of, I do like they essentially describe it as capitalism versus democracy, you know. And
Right. I mean, capitalism is the accumulation of wealth, right? I mean,
right.
It's not necessarily a parallel thing to democracy.
I know.
Democracy allows it to flourish.
But I was raised to believe that capitalism was good.
Well,
the best thing, in fact. No,
greed is good.
Yes, like I said.
The fact is that it's like capitalism is equated to democracy
right.
implicitly now, I think. And that's, they're kind of saying that might not actually be true. You know, like they can coexist, but...
Like I said, one enables the other, right?
Right. One enables the other, but the other one does not enable democracy right. necessarily.
And they're not necessarily orthogonal to one another.
Right.
Right. I mean,
slightly askew from each other.
Right. We have free speech, but since money is speech, then that is no longer free in that sense.
That's the way it should be, Steve.
Of course.
I praise our overlords.
Patriotic American that would never dream of deviating from the prescribed thought patterns.
Well, I mean, basically what happens in the book is a big financial redistribution of money.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. And then if you kind of, you know, keep doing that, right, at some point, even though you may not be rich, at some point you'll be richer than other people, in which case you'll be having your money taken away and given to other people.
Right.
Right. So it's like the real question is, where does it end?
But in the building, it seemed like somewhat of a communal existence. Like people weren't really paying each other.
Yeah. There's definitely like, you know, the food was a shared resource.
Right.
And if you wanted to eat meat, then you basically had to work on the farm every once in a while to slaughter things yourself.
Right.
So that was a limited resource. And it wasn't a completely closed system. They only made about 15% at best of their own food inside the building.
It was not a true arcology.
Yeah.
It was somewhat there. I thought it was more than 15, but it was still like, you know, you're right. They still did need some external stuff, but they were trying as much as they could to make it sort of a commune, essentially.
Right. Other buildings definitely made more of their own food.
Right. Although, what building was it again? The Met?
Yeah.
And which I guess is a very iconic building that does look like a building in Venice, which I think...
It's the MetLife building.
Oh, it's the MetLife building.
Yeah. But it was originally built in the 30s, and they didn't actually have enough money to finish the overall construction. And so they were saying that it's really just like the first 30 or 40 stories that was the original base of what was going to be a 100-story building.
Oh. So it's like it is very – it's good for withstanding storms and stuff because it's like extra
– It's a great squat,
extra beefy,
you know,
for,
right.
squat building. And
but I think they also said it has like a peak, and then the building kind of looks like a building in Venice. And I think that's why the author – chose that or something.
You know, now that all the streets are flooded, it is a lot like Venice, which
right.
I think if you watch a lot of, you know, documentaries about Venice, it's like the people who live there aren't entirely that happy about it.
Right.
Right. They spend a lot of time and money and effort and, you know, trying to keep their buildings from falling into the ocean, much like in right. this future.
Right. And so, yeah, it's kind of, you know, back to what we were saying at the beginning, where it's like all this technology to deal with, you know, climate change, you know, it's like, oh, look, everything can be carbon negative, including building and all this stuff. You know, we suddenly discovered this after basically the pulse. Ha ha. Yes. Not an EMP, I think.
it's definitely more carbon neutral because, well, there isn't as much land to, you know, make power plants.
Right.
And,
but they were saying,
raise a bunch of cows and pigs. And
right. But they were saying something like, you know, essentially all these processes that had been dumping carbon into the atmosphere. They said, you know, well, you know, we've found new ways, and there are, you know, right now there's some technology that, you know, you could make things carbon neutral or carbon negative, but, you know, hey, that's not economically feasible because it's not the cheapest way to do it. You know, we couldn't possibly do that until in the book, it's like when the quote pulse happened, which I may be misunderstanding this, but in the book, it sounds like the pulse was when, you know, a bunch of big, like, you know, glaciers melted.
Right. And I actually think that's a pre-existing term. I think that's
it may be.
You know, something that people actually described might happen with sea levels.
So, yeah, I guess I didn't research that, but it kind of threw me for a loop because this is an apocalyptic, you know, subject matter. And so pulse for me means EMP, you know. And so it's like, you know, I'm because they say, you know, there's, you know, the first pulse and the second pulse. And I'm thinking, okay. And they're also talking about lost financial records. So I'm thinking, okay, this means they've, you know, they've lost their computers and their storage and all that stuff has gotten fried from an EMP. And then
I think it just got wet.
Yeah. I think that's what happened, but it was so I'm willing to believe it was a pre-existing term, but it was kind of confusing without explicitly saying
it was easy to conflate with like a post nuke setting, but I'm not even sure that this is post-apocalyptic because...
It's just awesome, Barry.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, you know, a bunch of stuff changed. Not a whole lot of people died in it, right? They just all moved up in buildings and we are now living in a denser society. And
right.
You know, except for Denver, which didn't seem to have a problem.
I'm not sure what the point of... I mean, there must be something I'm missing where it's like Denver's the place that all the money goes when...
Mountains, I assume.
Yeah, that's probably it. And they're like, it's not going to flood, but it's like, it has to go. It's going to have to flood a lot for you to have to go up to Denver. You
know? I mean,
yeah. It's only a mile high.
It's like, you know, when there's a rise of how much did they say it was, like 10 feet or I don't even know what it was, but
I want to say that it was closer to like
50 feet, like,
yeah, 50
yeah,
or,
but, and that's, you know, if, yeah, but if you're in Denver, then, you know, if you're at the top of the Rocky Mountains, you can just like, oh no, none of this is happening.
Well, right. And they did kind of say it's not necessarily Denver. There's, you know, one of the characters was sort of the New York citizen, which I kind of liked that because he's sort of like the linking narration explaining what's going on. But he also was sort of like, oh, we couldn't have possibly done any of this stuff until something actually happened. And, you know, so... You know,
I mean, that may be accurate.
Yeah, I think there actually is some historical accuracy in that Denver is sort of a seat of real estate power. I think a lot of people who just tended to own a lot of real estate have settled there. And I'm sure we'd have to go and do some more research, but I think that there is a grain of truth to that.
We should really, work hard on that.
Did you just mark me for that? Damn.
Actually marked you for some other reason. I don't remember anymore. I don't keep those in my head.
There's a little Sharpie mark on my forehead now.
Yeah, I put a little X on your forehead. Yes. You're in the Manson cult now. So it reminded somebody of a manga.
Oh, yes, there's this manga, which I'll attempt to butcher, Yokohama Kaidashi Kiko. It's basically a post-flood apocalypse manga about, you know, these robots or androids that, you know, run a cafe in the future. And like, you know, it's a very kind of,
is it a cat cafe?
Maybe it's like, it's
maybe it's hard to tell.
Well, okay. Two things about this. One, there was no official English version of it. You can only find online translations, you know, fan translations of it.
Totally accurate.
Totally accurate. Yeah, there was some discussion about two different versions of it and the accuracy merits of the different ones. I read it about 15 years ago, but the interesting thing about it really was the flooding bit, and also the real thing that's different about it is that it's a very slow motion kind of. It's not like an action plot. It's sort of like what it's like to live in the flood and kind of like hang out, you know, in the countryside where everything's like half flooded. And it wasn't exactly like this book, but the flooding part kind of reminded me of it. And then maybe want to go.
It's kind of like now, like when you're living in Hawaii where, you know, water level's slowly rising, but, you know, there's also like a volcano that's, you know, slowly like pushing you out into the water.
So it's like, hey, we're getting more land. We're making land here.
That's right. It's flattening out the island.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Did we have any more discussion points we wanted to cover?
It's a big shout out to Carhartt brand clothing at the beginning of the book, which I appreciate because I do enjoy wearing my Carhartt products.
Makes you look real street.
Yes. Please sponsor
I don't remember the shout out, but...
Neither do I, but...
And I'd also like, you know, much like Kevin has nitpicks about codes, there was I had a disagreement about... There was a statement about baseball being invented in Madison Square Garden or something, which is not really true.
Yeah, well, I suspect that, sometimes New Yorkers that I know will basically sort of like, oh, everything you do is sort of like a miniature version of what we do in New York. I remember like, oh, right. But you don't have real Whole Foods out here in California. The real Whole Foods are in New York. I'm just like, yeah, they're real big. I'm sure that.
Yeah. You know what? You guys also birthed Donald Trump, so congratulations.
Yeah. Alrighty.
Go take credit for that one.
Yep. Just anyway, favorite scenes. My favorite scene was Amelia trying to rehome these rowdy polar bears, and then they get loose. She accidentally lets them out into the rest of the Zeppelin, blimp, dirigible, whatever. And
one has an internal frame, Stephen.
Right.
Yes, I think they said it was a dirigible.
Yes, indeed. My favorite scene there is she's hiding in a closet and they tip the entire blimp Zeppelin thingy up and down vertically to send as many of the polar bears down as they possibly can. And she figures out how to improvise helium balloons onto herself, but it makes her voice extremely squeaky at the same time.
And meanwhile, she's broadcasting this whole thing.
Right, exactly. So it turns into this bizarre ballet dance where she's like, you know, like mountain climbing all the way up this hallway up. And then she, you know, goes sailing up, shoots this polar bear with a trank gun. And I thought that was, to my mind, sort of the most cinematic, the most visually appealing scene in the whole thing, because most of the rest of it was people sitting around talking and occasionally making financial deals.
And they, then, you know, at one point she sort of calls Charlotte or whatever and like, hey, what's up? She's like, I'm stuck in a closet on my thing with bears like outside. I don't know what to do.
Right.
And like Vlade or someone's like, well, why don't you try tipping it? Maybe they'll fall off the back, or she does, or somebody. I forget who.
That was the
was
thing
that Franklin, I don't even know.
No, that was Vlade. That was the thing that surprised me the most. She's doing a random phone a friend and it worked.
Right.
I'm going to use my lifeline phone call now.
Because, you know, if she got onto our group chat, mostly she'd have gotten a bunch of, you know, weird jokes.
And probably some similar suggestions.
Yeah, well, hopefully.
Yeah, I like that Vlade also had some sort of, you know, offhand remark about like, well, that was unexpected.
It actually worked. Oh, well, funny.
It was like when she mentioned she's in trouble and kind of gives an encapsulated version of the problem. He's like, well, I am completely unsurprised. Yeah, that was one of my favorite scenes as well. And I think the sort of the long drawn out excavation or sucking up of the gold was my second. Yeah. You know, it's a toss-up. I can't say if it's, you know, which one I like more, but the enthusiasm that Roberto and Stefan have is it was a bit infectious.
Okay.
Kevin? Yeah, I like the bear scene as well, though. All the Zeppelin scenes were awesome, and so, you know, the general, like, anything occurring on a Zeppelin like that just makes it awesome, so that part's good. I did like her random rescue of the sky city that I guess they have, you know, it's like, well, we need places to live, so we just live in these like balloon cities and a bunch of the balloons that popped randomly.
And yeah, so it's like they some were Dutch city that they basically inflated and like let go.
And they're like, oh crap, you know, a bunch of, and she just happens to see it, and she like, you know, reduces her buoyancy to rush down and grapple onto it. So that was, you know, very cinematic as well, I guess. Right.
And the Zeppelin is trying to talk her into, the AI on the Zeppelin at least, was trying to talk her into filming it. And she's like, you know,
she's like, don't repeat stuff that my producer are telling me.
Yeah.
She's like, producers, you are jerks.
All righty. So was there any tea?
I don't believe there was. That might be part of the reason why I enjoyed this book so much.
Well, I mean, my original favorite tea distributor, the Puerto Rico Importing Company on Bleecker Street, would have been completely swamped by the waters, which would mean at least temporarily there would have been a lot of tea in that area.
I will also say, what's up with the Herman Melville fetish in the book? I did like the
another famous New Yorker, I guess.
But I did like the book that it wasn't a book that the old guy had written that was like Herman Melville, like Doc Master or something. It wasn't that, but you know,
he wrote a biography about Herman Melville at some point.
But the name, it was like, you know,
it's Mr. Hexter, I think.
Yeah, Mr. Hexter had written a book, but he was like a customs. Oh yeah, Herman Melville, customs inspector, which sounds like this bizarre, like.
Well, it sounds like it could be a manga.
Yeah.
It could be like a Law and Order offshoot.
Yeah. Dun, dun.
Melville, customs inspector.
Just this guy in the corner saying, "I prefer not to." Sorry, there's a Bartleby the Scrivener joke there.
Ahab.
Indeed. So yeah, who does Barry want to be?
I don't know. Why don't you guys tell me?
I kind of thought Vlade, but
yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Or the citizen.
Which one's the citizen?
The crotchety sort of New York generic citizen. Narrator, yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I think I'd want to be Vlade. It sounds like he's in a pretty good position. You know, he's got part of the gold and he's got the building. Things are good.
I mean, I would want to be Amelia, but I think realistically, Kevin and I are Mutt and Jeff.
Well, yes, I did like that. That at one point they're saying, "Well, who are we in this story?" And they decide that they were the two, you know, the characters in the Muppets that were up on. You know,
why do we always come here?
Yeah, Stadler and Waldorf.
Stadler and Waldorf.
Yeah,
yes.
They were like up there, you know, making fun of everybody. He's like, I guess we're kind of like those guys.
Oh, look at those idiots down there.
Yeah, I just want to, you know, I guess maybe I would be, if it wasn't them, I'd be like the assisted migration or something. I could be the...
You want to be Franz?
I could be Franz.
you want to be a Zeppelin.
I just want to fly around and be awesome.
You want an internal substructure?
I mean, technically he does have an internal substructure.
Yes, I do, I guess.
True from a certain point of view.
Certain point of view? Sorry, Luke Skywalker.
Thank you.
Yes. Okay, well, I'm looking outside and I'm seeing the waters are rising, so I think it's time to sublease
club and go
top,
in a drink.
Top half of your building here.
You're going to have to build something up there. Otherwise, you're going to have to enjoy living on a roof.
I'll play the fiddle.
And no falling through.
All right, well tradition. Then, until next time, we have been Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi.